This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will talk with the former Louisiana State University Chancellor Mike Martin. He led the Old War School's Baton Rouge campus for more than 4 years, and he is now the Chancellor of the Colorado State University system, still passionate about higher education in Louisiana. Misses the Bayou State, and we'll talk to him about what's going on in the world of higher education nationally and in our state, with 67% of the funding cut in the last 6 years. Also on the show, F. Edward Chamberlain. His book is Island, How Islands Transform the World. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Your numbers are 877-217-5757, wherever you are, or you may dial locally, 297-5633. You may reach us by email at inkstershow@wrkf.org. Frank Barnett is producing, and our guest is former Louisiana State University Chancellor of the Baton Rouge campus, Mike Martin, who a couple of years ago made an announcement that he would be leaving the Old War School to go to Colorado State University in Fort Collins when he heads the university system there. And he is joining us from beautiful Colorado. Good to hear your voice once again, Chancellor Martin.
Great to be chatting with you, Jim. I miss a lot of good folks there, yourself included, and it's nice always to catch up on news in Louisiana and all that's going on in Baton Rouge.
Well, I know Louisiana made quite an impression on you. You and your wife, Jan, really liked it here.
We really did. We have still many wonderful friends in Baton Rouge and in Louisiana, and it was a special time in our lives. And, you know, there were some challenges that came with the job, but there were certainly many great outcomes that came with just the wonderful people in the area.
Well, you stayed as chancellor about as long as Nick Saban stayed as head football coach, and I mean this as a compliment. You're the Nick Saban of chancellors.
Well, that's a nice thing to hear. I wish I would have had his salary and his hair. Those are the two things I most admired about Nick Saban. But nonetheless, it was a good run for the time I was there, at least. It was, you know, as you know, we had many conversations about it were kind of relentless budget cuts and the other challenges. But beyond that, I mean, it's a wonderful part of the world, and it's a place, as you and I have chatted as well, that desperately, in my judgment, needs a great university system. And I think LSU is doing the best they could to lead that charge.
297-5633 is who speak to the always provocative and compelling Mike Martin, the former chancellor at Louisiana State University. He arrived here in August of 2008 and made quite an impression in his more than 4 years, and did so amid a flurry of budget cuts, which continue. The budget for higher education and for LSU has been cut by more than two-thirds over the last 6 years. How difficult was it to battle that?
Oh, I think I said to you as well once, I said, Louisiana State was one of the best places I've ever worked, but one of the worst jobs I've ever had, because it was just a daily grind of trying to find ways to keep a very good institution afloat during incredibly challenging times. And we lost some really good people as a result of it. And, you know, it was difficult, but that's what, you know, we've said as well. That's why you draw the big bucks, but it's also what those of us who have been in higher education all these years care about. And so it wasn't a day at the circus every day, but fortunately there were so many good people around that helped make it work that at least we had a team committed to the students and the quality of the institution, and that helped a great deal. So, you know, I wouldn't want to do it again, but I'm glad that I had the opportunity to be part of that effort that kept a good institution as good as it could possibly be under the circumstances.
You liked the people, but you didn't like the politics.
Well, politics are tough there, as you well know, and I understand that continues. You know, I it was difficult because it was always hard to get a forum in which to make the case you really believed needed to be made, because it was just a continual flurry of returning service, so to speak. But the folks are terrific. I mean, the people on the campus were great, and there are many, many supporters, as you know, around that town and around the state and beyond, who put their passion, in many cases their checkbook, behind LSU, and that at least restored your faith every day that the folks out there understood how important it was.
Have you talked at all with F. King Alexander?
I have. We had a chat at a meeting not long ago. I think he's a good guy. I think he's in the business for the right reasons. I joked with him a little bit that his parents named him King, obviously having great expectations for him, and that my parents had toyed with the idea of naming me Inmate Martin. So I told him, he started out with a bunch of sort of broader image with the name King Alexander, but I think he's a good guy and probably exactly the right style for the times.
And the new dean of the music and dramatic arts program is named Queen, so we have a king and a queen on the LSU campus.
And in some respects, you're the prince of the community as well. So, I mean, we've got a whole royal family going here.
Well, I suggested that maybe the real prince, guy from Minnesota, a state you know well, that he should come down and do a concert, and then we would have a king and a queen and a prince.
Prince Nelson, he's fairly famous, and I'm sure he's probably looking for a gig these days. So,
well, he's coming.
Not
to
a
the,
bad idea. Jim.
Coming to the Superdome on July 4th at the Essence Festival, so maybe he can make a stop in Baton Rouge.
I think it would look good.
Well, last week, and this was a story that didn't get a lot of play, but the Reveille covered it. It says, as F. King Alexander reigned in his one-year anniversary as LSU president, the Board of Supervisors decided it was time to create a presidential evaluation protocol at its meeting Friday. The board doesn't have one yet, said Chairwoman-elect Ann Duplessis. We need to facilitate this. That's just what chancellors and administrators love to hear, that they're going to be evaluated by their boards, right?
Oh, we do it here as well. I get it. But it's amazing how much time we spend trying to determine where we spend the rest of our time. And so it's always an interesting process. And the fact of the matter is, it's pretty clear when leaders are leading well, and I know that processes are necessary, and boards like to do those things. But it's always seemed to me to be a case where the performance is pretty obvious, but maybe from time to time a little measure isn't a bad idea. I didn't know that was happening. And it probably keeps the board busy, and maybe it keeps them from doing other things that might not be quite as constructive.
297-5633 for Mike Martin, who appeared on this show many times when he was chancellor. It was always fun to talk with him. And I would see him. He was a visible person in the community. I would see him at Highland Coffees and at Louie's, and we really miss him. David asked the question, did the hostility toward higher education in Louisiana politics factor into your leaving LSU?
Well, certainly. I never left any place for a push. It's always been a pull, and the Colorado job was a fascinating one, but it made it a little easier to consider it given the tense arrangements, as you know, and the kind of revolving door arrangements with higher ed. At the time I was there, there was a good deal of change going on within the Board of Regents. Of course, the Board of Supervisors went through a fairly split time. We got messages from the Capitol that had less to do with good educational policy and more to do with whatever the political moment was. So all those things made it easier to consider an alternative. But it's like everything else in life. You take the opportunities when they come, and you don't look back and second-guess that too much. But certainly the political environment there was not probably as constructive and as positive as many of us would have preferred.
Well, you left, and I think you could have been the greatest chancellor LSU's had if you'd stayed long enough, and it looks like King Alexander is certainly a competent person, but he's got two jobs, chancellor and president. What do you think of that?
Well, I think there are some benefits to it, but I think what's hurt to some extent, and Lisa's, I hear this from friends on campus, the concern that sort of in the great scheme of things, Baton Rouge has been lost a bit, that there isn't quite as energetic a spokesperson or a strong a voice coming out of Baton Rouge now as the flagship. And that would be disappointing. I think there's a very good provost there who has done a good job of continuing to raise the flag for the Baton Rouge campus. But I do think there is sometimes a bit of a loss of identity when you blend the two jobs together. I understand why they did it. I've had many conversations with people prior to it. And perhaps in the long run it'll work out well. But I think that initial loss of a singular focus individually on that major campus could be costly in some ways.
Now, you lost some good people along the way, too. It's amazing how resilient LSU is. Eli Jones, for example, brilliant guy, dean of the School of yep. Business. He left to go to the University of Arkansas, and he's replaced by another brilliant guy, Dick White. But it had to be tough to see people of that talent go to other places in what amounted to lateral moves at best.
Well, and you lost Jane Fleener, you lost David Cronrath, you lost a great scientist in Steve Soper. After I left, Eric Munday left for Kentucky, one of the really bright young stars, I thought, in administration. You go down the list, and it was pretty devastating. And, of course, Eli and I were very close and good friends and did a lot of work on fundraising around the new business school and their building. And I knew how good he was. And, I made an all-out push to keep him in my last few months there. But, again, it was one of those things, the budget just wore him out. Arkansas offered him a very nice deal, and he took it, and many others did as well. And it's hard to recover from those. Dick White's a great guy, a wonderful human being. I think the world of him. But it would have been better to keep Dick doing what he does well and keep Eli and the Eli Joneses of LSU in place. But that's the cost of going through the kinds of difficult times LSU went through.
As I have noted on this show, and it was Treasurer Kennedy who gave the numbers a few weeks ago, the higher education in the last 6 years has been cut from $1.6 billion a year in state funding to $500 million. That's 67%. It's hard to sustain a great higher education system when you don't have the fuel to do it, isn't it?
And I understand the constraints on pushing up in tuition and fees in Louisiana. It's hard to do both politically and sort of ethically. And you're exactly right. The erosion starts, and it starts without being obvious to everybody. But then you begin to see this flood of people leave. Since I've left, Catrice Albert has left, who was leading the diversity program there, has gone to the University of Minnesota, my alma mater. And you just don't. The public doesn't fully appreciate that erosion. Two things happen. You defer maintenance on the building, and you defer maintenance on the human resource pool. And that was beginning to happen at a pretty rapid rate. And the only way to turn that around is to decide that you're going to reinvest in higher education, and particularly in an institution as powerful as LSU was and could be. So that's a huge cut, and we all had to suffer through it, and it was, unfortunately, will be imposed on future students and future citizens in ways that we may not fully appreciate today even.
Is this a Louisiana phenomenon, or is it a nationwide trend?
Well, it's a nationwide trend in some ways, although I think in many parts of the country the trend is being reversed. Here in Colorado, we've had 2 years in a row in which the governor's budget did offer some restoration. We have $100 million of new money into higher ed overall in this most recent legislature, and there was a modest upturn last year. Several other states, I think, are seeing a recovery. Obviously, the two leading the way are Wyoming and North Dakota because of their enormous energy incomes and the fact that there, between the two states, there are about 30 people that live there. But the bottom line is that most places, I think, are now trying to recover as best they can with the recovery of the economy, and I hope that eventually comes to Louisiana. The longer this goes on, the more likely it is, as other universities see their budgets improve, that they'll pick off the very best Louisiana has. And so there's always sort of a yard sale going on if it looks as though the institution isn't recovering, and I think that's still a high possibility for LSU.
297-5633 is your number. We'll take a short break and return with Chancellor Michael V. Martin of Colorado State University, 44,000 students and counting, and he was at LSU for more than 4 years during some of the most turbulent times in the history of the old war school as far as budgets are concerned. We'll talk more with Chancellor Martin when we return Inkster's show at WRKF.org online. Back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Chancellor Mike Martin is our guest. He left LSU a little less than 2 years ago and has been the chancellor the last couple of years at Colorado State University. I think your office is actually in Denver, isn't it?
It is. We're downtown. And it's nice to be downtown Denver, but you know, Jim, I've been 41 years on a campus. And it is hard not to be on a campus every day. Of all of the things that have been stressful for me, the budget isn't one of them here, but not being on campus every day. Though we have two campuses, two physical campuses, and one of the fastest growing online campuses in the country. So I get to visit from time to time. And I always tell the president at Fort Collins, who's actually driving the car I'm in, that I show up and I'm not like everybody's uncle. I come and give free advice. He gives me a sandwich and sends me home. But at least it gives me a sandwich, but it gives me a chance to kind of feel the campus again. And that's also been one of the pleasures of working. And we've got three great campus presidents. And so I get to be kind of the old guy who shows up and provides whatever support I can. But downtown Denver is also not a bad place to be. We're right on the 16th Street Mall. So there's plenty of places to hoof around for lunch and other events going on. But I also miss Baton Rouge. Yeah. We traveled in the same culinary circles, you and I, and I miss them as well.
Well, is there a reasonable facsimile to Louis in Fort Collins or in Denver?
There actually is. There's a couple, and there's one right around the corner from my office that I hoof over to from time to time and overdo my cholesterol. But but there's no Frenchie as you have at Louis. The entertainment isn't quite up to the standards of Louis.
Well, Frenchie does provide that.
It always struck me as interesting that a guy named Jimmy owned Louis. It seemed somehow dishonest, but it fit nonetheless.
There we go. Kerry Thomas writes, Chancellor Martin is speaking truth this morning. We have to value education in order to really improve it. Now, why isn't there outrage about this 67% cut? Now I hear some editorial columnists up in arms about it, but the people at large, I don't see any marches to the Capitol to restore funding for higher education. Why isn't there more outrage about this?
I think part of the problem is that you don't feel the impact right away. I mean, we I think people across the system in Louisiana, the leaders that I knew, did as good a job as they could of papering over the worst of it. But I think eventually it'll visit itself upon the state, and there should be outrage. Our students organized, probably my second year there, organized a statewide attempt for the students to be heard. And I think they did a pretty good job, but, you know, with students, they graduate and move on, and it's not a sustainable movement. But, you know, we organized a flagship coalition of some major players around the state and beyond to make the case for LSU, and I think they've done a nice job of that. But I am disheartened to some extent across this country that there hasn't been a greater outcry to sustain what was one of the world's premier public higher education system. And I'd like to believe that we can hang on to that because people care enough to speak out and make their emotions and their desires known.
877-217-5757, wherever you are, Hugh at LSU, you're on with Chancellor Mike Martin. Hi, Hugh.
Mike, I don't know if you remember me, Hugh Buckingham.
I know you, Hugh. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, listen, I was out in New Mexico. Do you still have any connections with New Mexico State down in Las Cruces?
Well, of course, I've stayed in close contact with many people there, including their new president, Gary Carruthers, who was the dean, and I made him vice president while I was...
Okay. I'm not sure if we lost Chancellor Martin or if we lost Hugh, but right now we've got... we lost the chancellor, so let's see if we can restore him, Frank. Chancellor Martin mentioned New Mexico State University, as did Hugh at LSU. He was there as the head of that system for 4 years, and then came to LSU where he was situated for more than four, and now is at Colorado State University. And Dr. Martin served 6 years as Vice President for Agriculture and Natural Resources at the University of Florida. Well, he led the school's Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences, and he used to ride on the same plane with one Steve Spurrier, the great football coach at the University of Florida, who lost, he has the best SEC record of any coach in the history of the league based on his time at Florida. It's been diminished a bit by not winning as prolifically at South Carolina, but Mike Martin said, like LSU, when Steve Spurrier wanted the school plane, Steve Spurrier got it first. And we lost you for a moment, Chancellor yep. Martin, but we were talking about athletics and a question. Well, I'll get to the question, but in your last appearance on this show, you said that perhaps one of the reasons why there isn't more outrage about LSU in particular is that the football team has done so well that there's this perception that if the football team is doing well, then my goodness, things must be peachy keen.
I don't think there's any doubt about that, Jim. I think that disguises a lot of what's going on. The enthusiasm around sports and football in particular sort of overshadows other things going on on the campus. And I think that's a good thing that there's that enthusiasm, but it would be nice if we could also send a message that they are student athletes, not athlete students, and therefore the student athlete should have the very best university as well as the very best football team. And that certainly has been the case, I think, in many instances where sports have sort of disguise the fact that other things are going on beneath the surface of the institution and not obvious to everyone who is both a fan of football and a fan of the academic programs. I will say this, one of the things I was impressed by at LSU is many of the big boosters of sports were also investors in the academic enterprise. And that was, to me, a very satisfying thing. You know, we went to many of those donors for buildings, including business and engineering and others. And the same people who wrote checks to TAF were willing to write checks to the larger institution. So in that sense, there was a very good glow that came. But when the budgets were cut, I think you're exactly right. The glow coming off of other things kind of dimmed the glow that ought to have been coming off of academics.
Well, the academics at LSU quite often, as far as national publicity, they take second tier to what's happening with the athletic program. And you worked at the University of Florida, so you know this phenomenon. Yeah. Do you think athletes should be paid?
You know, I actually don't. I think that they. I think there has to be some recognition of the full cost of attendance and perhaps some other things provided, like long-term insurance for injuries and maybe additional financial aid to finish a degree if you played out your eligibility. But I'm not a fan of paying athletes. For one thing, I think it opens up a very complicated set of conversations. I mean, how does it fit into Title IX? I think baseball gets, 11.5 scholarships. Do you prorate the pay around a third of a scholarship? And moreover, I think the athletes at a place like LSU and certainly at CSU, if they take advantage of their sports scholarship, will most certainly get an outstanding education that will serve them the rest of their life. And if they're good enough to play at the next level at a place like LSU, they get every possibility to expose that talent. They get great coaching. They get great tutoring. They get great travel arrangements. And they get to play with some of the finest football players or baseball players or whoever as teammates. I've said this before. I think you and I had this conversation. I got a little bit to know Stephen Ridley before he left LSU to go play in the pros. And we had a conversation after the Cotton Bowl in which he looked pretty good and that raised his stake. But running behind the line at Minot State, my guess is he'd be driving a bread truck if he didn't get an education. And so there are many benefits I don't think everyone sees to being in a big-time program. So I'm not a fan of, and I've made this known to Mark Emmert and others, I'm not a fan of paying athletes. I think it will also create a clear two-tiered system. A handful of big programs that can afford it, and a whole bunch of other programs that can't.
All right, 297-5633. A question from Melissa asking, are you aware and are you dismayed about that your former colleague Jim Lorenz has been canned as chancellor at Southern University?
I really am. I gave Jim a call. I told him then, as I would tell him again if he's listening, if there's ever a way I can help him out, I will do it, because I think he did a wonderful job of bringing that institution through probably its most trying times. And I believed he was a very good.
All right. I think we've lost the chancellor again, at least for him. There he is. He's back. You're bullish on Jim Lorenz, who led Southern during the same kind of budget cuts that you faced at LSU. And, of course, in this community, the community college has resulted in many students who would have gone to Southern going there. And so the budget has been even more curtailed as a result of fewer people on campus. So Southern University is a big part of this community, though, and you have noted that Baton Rouge, Louisiana, is the only city in America with two land-grant universities in the same town.
And I think that's a huge benefit to the state and to Baton Rouge. And as I say, I was disheartened to see Jim not stay in that role, and I have continued to reach out to him to say, you know, whatever he chooses to do next, if he needs a cheerleader, I'll be the first one in line.
Okay. What about Common Core? I know you followed. In fact, I got an email from you expressing some concern about Governor Jindal's switch on this issue. What do you think is going on?
You know, I think this is where politics trumps really good policy. You know, every higher education organization that I'm familiar with, and several of which I am either on a board or an active member, have fully endorsed Common Core as a new standard that gives students a real chance to succeed in college, as well as come out of high school with a good education. And it's turned out to be a political football that really, I think, does great harm. I know that the Governor Jindal was initially supportive of Common Core. I know that the politics of the moment seems to have eroded that. Obviously, from what I've read in The Advocate and heard from others, he's sort of swimming upstream against some very powerful organizations. I've never thought of Law B as a left-leaning, radical organization. And I've never thought of people like, say, Lane Grigsby as being a closet Marxist. I mean, these are all people who I think understand the need for a strong education system, and Common Core moves in that direction. So it's very disheartening. As I think I told you, I kind of jokingly said to you, I think that the governor is likely now to declare that the 100-meter dash is only 80 meters long in Louisiana so everybody can run a good time. And I'm not sure that's a good thing for anybody.
The governor has been accused of putting his national aspirations ahead of the state needs and objectives. Is that fair?
Well, you know, I think that the people who know better than I have said that, and I'm willing to believe that they have a point. All I know is that this is a case where whatever the underlying politics are, in the long run, it will not serve the students of the state well. And I think that's come out of the state superintendent's office and out of the chairman of the statewide board, Chris Romer. And so whatever the...
All right. Let's see if we can get the chancellor to a better location as he drives through lovely Colorado. There are probably some hills that are impeding transmission right now, but he's a guy who obviously still has great passion for Louisiana State University, where he served for more than 4 years living on the lakes and the chancellor's house. And he... according to most, did a good job during austere times, and I think we've got the chancellor back. Did want to ask you a question from Frank in University Acres, saying, how is it being in a state that has collegiate wrestling, and should collegiate wrestling be brought back to Louisiana State University?
Well, you know, I'm a wrestling fan. I'm not a wrestler, as you know, before my build, unless it's sumo, I suppose, But I think it's a great sport because I think it's a great training ground. A man I got to know very well during my life, Norman Borlaug, who won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1970, told me that much of what he learned about being a great scientist came from his career as an All-American wrestler at the University of Minnesota. And So I believe that. So maybe there's something to be said for that crossover, and Borlaug certainly was a champion of wrestling as a way of learning how to cope with adversity and still come out on top. So I'm a wrestling fan for a combination of reasons, not the least of which Norm Borlaug told me I should be.
I mentioned briefly that you used to share the same plane with Steve Spurrier at the University of Florida. How was that experience?
Well, I think I told you. Florida, when I was there, had three airplanes, and the pecking order for using them was president, football coach, basketball coach, and then the vice president, and I was the vice president. So periodically, I would have a plane scheduled to go somewhere, and Steve Spurrier would decide he needed to go as well. So I could occasionally then hitchhike along and be dropped off and picked up. And it was always interesting because Steve's a nice guy, and I enjoyed getting to know him a little bit better as a result of flying on the plane with him. But the truth of the matter is he really is only interested in two things, or maybe three. His family is one, but golf and football. So if you wanted to have a conversation about anything else on the plane, you were wasting a lot of time. He was always pleasant to me, but I always find it interesting that I was trying not to only talk about those subjects, and it turns out that's about the only subjects he was willing to talk about. But I did quiz him a little bit about his approach to football and his philosophy, and I learned a bit about the way coaches approach things. So it was always entertaining in that sense, but you weren't likely to come away with a deep political conversation or a philosophic conversation or a discussion about English literature. Kevin Cope would have had a really hard time on the plane.
I hear Nick Saban's the same way, but what about Les Miles? Does he talk about those kinds of things?
You know, he does. I was on the Tiger Tour with him several times. I didn't go to every one, but I went to many and rode on the plane and to some other events. And, you know, Les is actually a pretty interesting guy. He's an economics major, so we talked a little about that. He reads a little history. I found Les much more engaging on a broader set of topics, no doubt about it. And I enjoyed Les. I mean, sometimes I wasn't entirely sure what he was talking about, but I always found it fascinating. And he did express many interests beyond just the narrow focus of his job, and I appreciated that.
I don't think he ever ate grass in your presence, though.
I know he did not. I observed him like everyone else, and I thought everybody has to have their own kind of quirky style, and he certainly has his.
And in your state now, you can smoke grass legally.
Yes, you can. And I will deny having ever done it, because it's true. And if I did, I didn't inhale. So,
in the facsimile of Highland Coffees in Denver, do you get a little grass or something like that?
I have not noticed much of it here. I guess there is a good deal that's sort of picking up as a result of legalizing marijuana. But, you know, for me personally, either I'm kind of disconnected from the environment I'm in, or I just don't know much of it. They've had medical marijuana here, obviously, for quite a while. And so it was kind of an expansion of that industry. And what I understand is more people come into the state to do it than many of the people in the states utilize. So we haven't noticed much of it. It's going to be interesting. Denver is... Hello?
Yeah, we're still with you.
And okay.
We'll hold that thought. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back
and wrap it up
with Dr. Michael V. Martin after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. A few more minutes with Mike Martin, who spent much of the hour with us, and we thank him. He is a busy man with a total enrollment of more than 44,000 students at Colorado State University and a budget of over $1 billion. How does that compare with LSU?
LSU wasn't quite that large, although it was a single campus at about, when we started out, a little over 800 million. So they're a similar scale. Our big growth, the campus in Fort Collins continues to be the campus of preference for Coloradans and is now a much bigger magnet for non-residents. But our real big growth has been in our online program, which has exploded from about 5,000 to 7,000. And that may be the biggest single difference in our system. Or to about 12,000 now. And so it's been a major addition to the system. But they're similar in so many ways. Two great land grants, two institutions committed to the land grant mission, in a 21st century way. We're out in the state right now on a kind of an engagement tour with the president of the campus and another vice president, a number of us just connecting with the people we serve. And we certainly tried to do that, and LSU has tried to do that at every turn. So they're more similar than different, and that's part of, you know, my passion has always been around the land-grant mission, and they're both two great land-grant universities.
Leo at LSU asks if you ever had a one-on-one meeting with Governor Jindal during your nearly 5 years as chancellor.
I did. I had a couple of one-on-ones, and I had a couple of very small group meetings as well, both arranged by first Timmy Teeple and then later Stephen Wagesback. And so, yeah, I did. And, you know, in most instances, we sort of agreed to disagree.
I'm sure he was a nice guy.
Yeah. I mean, I think he's very pleasant. He's obviously very intelligent. And I found, you know, there was never any sort of personal conflict that I ever felt. I think he knew where I was coming from, and I think he understood that I had both a personal passion and an obligation as the chancellor to be an advocate for LSU, and I took that seriously, and I think he did as well. So, you know, every encounter was certainly not combative, but obviously we had very different views of what ought to be done to fund higher education in the state, and particularly to fund LSU.
Now, the governor is obviously running for president of the United States. We hear a lot about that in Louisiana, but in Colorado, I would imagine Governor Jindal is still not very well known, and most people have no idea that the governor of Louisiana is interested in becoming leader of the free world.
I would guess that you would not find 1 out of 100 who would list him as a candidate if you stopped him on the street. It's the truth. Now, you know, that will change, obviously, with campaigning. But my guess right now is if 1% knew that he was a serious candidate for president, that would be a little bit surprising to me. And this is a split state. We've got a very popular Democratic governor. We've got, you know, there's going to be an election coming up here as well. But I don't think, at least in this part of the world that I travel in, Bobby Jindal is yet to really register on anybody's dashboard.
Well, Mike Martin is a man who is a great ambassador for Louisiana, even though he left us a few years ago. But you and Hubert Humphrey are two guys synonymous with Minnesota and Louisiana. That's not bad company, is it?
You know, I was just telling somebody, I said, I'd had a conversation with Angster on the radio in which we talked about Hubert getting his master's degree in Louisiana. And I said, I think Angster actually knows what he got a grades in every class. I mean, you knew everything there was to know.
Well, I know he bounced a check at Louis. Did you know that?
I did not know that. But, you know, I know one of his sons quite well, or I did. We went to college together. I'm going to call Bob Humphrey and see if they can cover that check. The last thing I want to do is leave a Minnesotan with a bad reputation at Louis. So that's about as tough as it comes on us the northern guys. But as you said, you know, I still have a great affection for and passion for that institution, but particularly the people who care deeply about it. And I wish nothing but the best for King and his leadership and everybody who is there. I found the enthusiasm for the place on that campus and the quality of the students to be first rate, and I missed the day-to-day interaction with them. And as you know, I spent many happy hours strolling from my office to the ice cream store, and I miss those days as well. It's a wonderful place, and I hope that the world turns around and the state finds a way to reinvest in such an incredibly valuable asset.
Frank Barnett says, I'm not sure he knew there was an ice cream store down the block from you. You can actually buy ice cream on campus, right?
You bet. The Dairy Science kids and that program have a great little ice cream store, and they knew when they saw me coming that I was coming for a heavy load of whatever was the special of the day. And occasionally students would see me coming and know that if they wandered along with me, I might actually buy them an ice cream cone. So, you know, you can either be popular or you can give people ice cream and pretend you're popular. And it worked out fine for me.
Well, we hope you'll be back soon for some ice cream on campus and some coffee at Highland and some biscuits at Louis.
Well, I will look forward to it, Jim, and hopefully we can have a conversation next time around. I'll be on a landline, but anytime I can weigh in on whatever matters, I will do it. But more than anything else, thank you again for both having given me the opportunity to to share what I think of the world, but also being a very good friend. I miss you, and I look forward to catching up again sometime. And if you get this way, the coffee and the breakfast is on me.
Well, I like your town. Although, I tell you what, when you go there, your skin dries out. When you've been in Louisiana, you don't appreciate the moisture in the air. You're going to shrivel up out there, Chancellor.
Well, my wife has said that as well, and she said my hair is getting real frizzy, all three of them. So we all have to suffer with that, but my wife makes that point every day. And so I get it. But come on out, and we'll dry you out for just a bit of time, Jim, anytime.
I would love that. Thank you, Chancellor. Take care, and good luck
to
you in Denver. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks a bunch. Bye-bye.
My pleasure. 297-5633 is your number, and we're joined now by J. Edward Chamberlain, University Professor Emeritus of English and Comparative Literature at the University of Toronto and a Fellow of the Royal Society of Canada. And he has written a compelling book, How Islands Transform the World. The book is entitled, appropriately, Island. Good morning, Dr. Chamberlain.
How are you today?
I'm doing well.
Good.
And you say one thing is for certain, large or small, flat or mountainous, barren or beautiful, far out at sea or close to the shore, islands are a central part of the world in which we live.
They are indeed. In some ways, we live on one, which is this island planet. They're all around us. We think about them all the time, one way or another. We imagine things happening on islands or going to islands. They're at the center of our lives in all kinds of ways.
Well, those of us who have grown up in cities where water is prominent, like the one in which this show is located, we have great appreciation for what water does to our outlook on life, in addition to being a vital part of the environment. I can't imagine living in a city that's landlocked with no waterways anywhere in sight.
I know what you mean. I mean, I've been to a few of them, never lived in one, but the rivers and lakes of the world seem to settle around them, and so most of our cities, big cities in the world, have some water nearby. Of course, these days, especially if you live on the ocean as I do, I live on the West Coast now. The prospect of rising water is always unnerving, but that's been the way of the world since time immemorial.
297-5633 if you'd like to join the conversation. An interesting man with a book that has an interesting approach to something that many of us take for granted, and that's the water around us. And whenever people talk about going on vacation, usually it's to some place that has water. An island of some kind is always appropriate, whether it's New York or Hawaii or wherever we want to go. It seems like we naturally gravitate to places that might be considered islands.
It's fascinating. It is fascinating why we do and how we do. And these days we can get there easily. For most of human history, it required some serious kind of catching of the breath and stepping into a boat and going across often a big body of water. And our sense of islands, I think, is still shaped by that recognition that we have to cross water, a domain that we're not at home in the water, even though we love to be by it, and that there's often dangers in going to islands as well as delights.
Well, we are fascinated by islands, no doubt about it. What do you exactly determine what an island is?
Well, that's a really central question. I'm often asked how many islands are there in the world, and my answer is that there's either 200,000 or 2 million, depending on how you count them, whether you count every little rock outcrop as an island, or whether you say, as they do with 1,000 islands up on the St. Lawrence River, an island has to have a tree growing on it, however small the tree and however small the body of land. Some of the definitions of islands or the word island in some languages catch the spirit of what we think of when we think of an island. The Chinese word for an island combines the ideograms for a mountain and a bird. And so an island is a place for a bird to land, however small. No one knew that when he was on the Ark settled in there on Mount Ararat when as the waters went down. So it's for a sailor, anything that is close to the surface is something to watch out for, is a kind of island. And so it kind of goes from there to the big islands of the world or the small islands where a lot of people live. About a billion people live on islands.
A billion?
About a billion, yeah. Yeah, which is astonishing.
A billion out of 7 billion.
Yeah, a billion out of 7 billion. But that's a lot of people on a lot of islands, and a lot of islands are island nations. Almost a quarter of the United Nations nations are island nations, which gives a sense of how independent people on islands often feel, and how much that sense of independence or uniqueness is kind of celebrated in our recognition of their status as nations.
Well,
some of them are very small, of course.
In our books, movies, art, from, as you said, Noah to Robinson Crusoe, we've always celebrated islands. What do islands do as far as bringing out the creative beings in us?
Well, you mentioned Robinson Crusoe. That catches one aspect of what they do. They require us to come to terms with the environment in ways that those of us on the mainland often don't have to do, because we can move from one place to another much more easily. Islands are places where we have to take account of the often quite small or quite unique flora and fauna around us. Rachel Carson of Silent Spring fame wrote a book called The Sea Around Us, in which she said there's no more delicately balanced relationship than that of island life to its environment. Darwin saw that too, with humans.
We've got a question from a listener about Darwin saying, what did he think about the origin of islands?
Well, that's a crucial kind of question. Darwin began his life as a scientist, as a geologist, and when he headed off on the Beagle on his 5-year voyage around the world, he spent a lot of time thinking about the geology as well as the natural history of islands. And he, not alone, but in small company in the mid-19th century, argued that islands weren't just what was left over when the water went down and mountaintops on continents stayed above the water. They came up from the ocean bottom, and people didn't really accept that until late in the 19th century. They didn't understand the volcanic nature of most ocean islands, and with that understanding came a new recognition of the unique natural life that there is on islands that come up on their own in the middle of the ocean and aren't just the remains of a continent.
So how do plants and animals get to islands?
Well, in all kinds of ways. Animals more slowly than plants, because birds often carry seeds and they drop them. Their bird droppings certainly are one way in which islands get populated by plants. Mammals, except for sea mammals, have a harder time getting to islands. Some of them get there on rafts, small animals, rafts and pieces of wood, or small floating sea kelp and various sea forms that float by. And then as people started to go to islands long, long, long time ago, certainly 40, 50,000 years ago, when the Aboriginal folks went to Australia, which was then closer to the Indonesian mainland, but was needed a boat crossing. They took some plants and animals with them, and the Polynesians did when they went and settled the islands of the Pacific.
All right, we're short on time, but another listener asks, your favorite islands?
Haha. My favorite island in some ways is the first one that I knew, a little island called Bowen Island, Klish Kleem, it's called by the Salish people. I love Haida Gwaii on the west coast. I love Fiji, Jamaica, where my wife is from. And then there's those islands of the imagination. Agatha Christie once said that an island should be a dream island, white sand and blue sea, built between sunrise and sunset.
The book is Island from J. Edward Chamberlain. We thank you for joining us today. Back tomorrow. Until then, stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.